So, I need to qualify the talk title right off the bat here. So, we are working on stream-associated amphibians, but some of the stream-associated amphibians breed in-stream, and some of the stream-associated amphibians are riparian. And what you're going to hear about today is the riparian cut, because we only started on the in-stream breeding ones this year, and we don't have enough information to present to you that will come in the future. So, so the riparian-associated amphibians I'm going to talk about are all salamanders. And the one that is probably most of concern is Van Dyke salamander. In Washington State, there are 5 species of terrestrial salamanders. 2 species are extremely widespread into uplands and are not of particular concern. But there are 3 species that are less common. One occurs only in the Willapa Hills in southwestern Washington. That's Dunn salamander. Second one, Van Dyke salamander, that I'm going to pretty much focus on today, is a Washington endemic. In fact, it's one of the only 2 amphibians that is endemic to the state of Washington. We suspected at one time that it might occur in extreme northwest Oregon, where there's good habitat, simply because there's a number of other amphibians that lap the Columbia River on both sides, but to date, we haven't found it. And Van Dyke's is a rather distinctive species in that it is probably the most cool-adapted amphibian that we have. It displays surface activity only below 14 degrees centigrade, which is about 57 degrees Fahrenheit and change. And it does that for the coastal populations, although recently, based on some work that Amy McIntyre did in the Cascades of Washington, apparently Van Dyke's, or what we call Van Dyke salamander there, may behave somewhat differently. But the stuff we have in the Chehalis is, at least in part, the Willapa Hills complex. And if you take a look at the distribution of Van Dyke's, it looks something like this. So we really have pretty much 3 cluster areas. On the Olympic Peninsula, in the Willapa Hills, and in the Cascades. And this distribution, which we developed relatively recently, is based on a little over 1,000 points gathered from quite a number of sources, and it updates the distribution map that was done basically back in 1999 with probably about 5 times as many points. But I'd like to emphasize that our knowledge of its distribution is still relatively limited. But we do have a sort of a basic understanding of at least some of its ecology, and I'm going to share that with some of you and then talk about what we've done basically in the Chehalis specifically. So, was that feedback?
That is feedback.
Okay, you got to be careful here. In a rather sort of course level analysis, comparing the 4 species, the 4 terrestrial salamanders that you have in the Willapa Hills, which is Dunn's, Ancitina, Van Dyke's, and Western Redback. And for those of you that know Western Redback and Ancitina, you're probably familiar with the fact that these species are very widespread on the landscape, well into uplands. Dunn's and Van Dyke's are the 2 species that appear to like moisture conditions, and Van Dyke's appears to like the more moist conditions. And we have some idea of this based on the distance to water that you typically find Van Dykes. So if you take a look at the distribution of the four species, you can see that that curve for Van Dykes is rather sharp. And I can say for a fact that you pretty much find about 98% of the Van Dykes in the field within about 6 meters of the wetted edge of streams. Now, we've done a lot of looking on the wetted edge of still water habitats, but it doesn't create the habitat conditions that Van Dyke seems to prefer, which is at least a partially loose matrix that has some rocky material in it, but that also varies as well too, and you'll see in a bit with some of the cover information. One thing that we did relatively recently that actually sort of surprised us, this was a study done back in 2001-2003, where we looked at cover objects associated with Van Dyke salamander. And Van Dyke's was really the only one that showed a significant differential with larger wood. And when I say larger wood, large log category there is 50 centimeters in diameter or greater. And we don't have a really good idea of the nesting situation with Van Dyke's other than we know it nests terrestrially. And there are nine records of nests. Eight of those nine records come from large wood that is larger than 75 centimeters in diameter. And there was a very interesting study that was done in Oregon in context of sort of the thermal profiles of large wood. It was done by Matt Kluber, who was a former SciTech of ours. And what he did basically is he did a master's degree and he compared small wood sizes, which were 20 to 40 centimeters in diameter, to ones that were 80 to 120 centimeters in diameter. And the striking aspect of that study was that the smaller diameter class really showed the distinctive signature of diel fluctuation in temperature. The large diameter class, it was almost completely attenuated. I mean, you could barely see any fluctuation with temperature data loggers that were put in the middle of it. And one of the other things that we know about Van Dyke's, although we know this based on very little data, that it seems to have a very long developmental period. So most of these terrestrial salamanders' developmental period is 70 to 90 days, and Van Dyke's has a developmental period of 150 days, or about 150 days. And given when we think most of the oviposition takes place, that 150 days would take you through the driest part of the summer. And so in order to successfully make it through there, given what is probable about Van Dyke's temperature tolerance, you would want to maintain a nest site basically that has low and moist enough temperature conditions through that period of time. Now, the one caution I would have, given that information, is that we're probably seeing the accessible nests, and we know nothing about the inaccessible ones, especially the inaccessible ones that may be in terrestrial habitat underground. But we know nothing about them. There is one of the nine nests that came from a terrestrial location that was not wood. So one of the things that we did to get some basic understanding, and we couldn't do this everywhere because basically surveying for the terrestrial salamanders is rather costly in time and also in terms of time window. And because Van Dyke's has surface activity that is rather restricted in time, There are two windows in which you can survey for it. You can survey during non-freezing conditions before the surface soil gets too warm and or dries out. Usually it gets too warm before it dries out. And your best time window is the post-winter thaw period, where you're in that time window below 14 degrees degrees centigrade near surface, and where it's not freezing. Your other time window is the fall. The fall window is rather unreliable because sometimes it gets cold before it gets wet enough. And if it gets wet enough before it gets cold, then you have a decent time to be able to survey. So what we did, mostly because dun salamander was also a target for us, is we chose the headwaters of the main stem Chehalis, the upper main stem Chehalis, because of course we know we have it in the Olympics, and we know it comes down, although we don't know the distribution very well, in the Cascades portion of the Chehalis. And we've surveyed almost 150 sites over a four-year period. And the reason there is a four-year period is mostly that time window. You've only got so much time to get to so many sites. And what this is showing you is the bare area on the upper middle of the photograph here is the area around Payel. So we're upstream in the main Chehalis headwaters. Boisvert Peak is over on the right-hand side here, and the extreme crest is just below the map. So one of the striking results from our work there is we wanted to get a better understanding of the geographic relationship with elevation. And so we broke the area into three more or less similar elevation blocks, below 750 feet, from about 750 to 1500 feet, and above 1500 feet. And you have to realize in the Willapas too, you don't have much area, a lot of area over 1500 feet. Boisvert Peak, the highest point in the Willapas, is just barely over 3000. And by the time you get up to 2300, you have a very small footprint there. What you should take home from this graphic, though, is, and you see the sample sizes on the number of sites below each of the three bars, is Van Dykes, you increase the likelihood of picking up Van Dykes with elevation very sharply. We didn't sample very many sites above 1,500 feet, but essentially almost 50% of the sites had Van Dykes present. So at this point, in terms of perspective for the ASRP, we know that Van Dykes is more frequent in high elevations, and there's a suspicion that you may have that pattern elsewhere, although we don't know exactly what happens as you get toward the coast, because we have found it at very low elevation along the coast, but we haven't done any systematic searching. And we know that it has this, of course, greater moisture and lower temperature requirement than close relatives, and we'd like to understand the link to large wood better. What's peculiar about Van Dykes is that pattern, that linkage to large wood, is in direct contradiction to what we see Van Dykes doing in the Cascades. And there seems to be very little association with large wood based on the data that Amy McIntyre collected during her master's work. In fact, the association is basically with V-shaped channel walls and rocky seeps, and there was very little wood situation involved. The other peculiar thing is that Van Dykes in the Cascades seems to have a temperature profile that may be different because it was surface active throughout the year. Of course, it can maintain relatively low temperatures in those microhabitats that it happens to be in, but we still don't understand what the real basis of the difference between the way Van Dykes is behaving in the Cascades and the way it's behaving in the coastal areas. So that combination of features makes Van Dykes particularly vulnerable in the current climate change trajectory, and that's should be pretty obvious with that kind of surface activity restriction, warmer seasonal temperature profiles, generating lower moisture and higher temperatures, especially if they do it earlier. You can envision a seasonal contraction, especially at lower elevations. And we would predict that over time, Van Dykes is not likely to maintain itself in that lowest elevation band, for example, where we saw it in the Willapa Hills. The loss of the species from lower elevations makes higher elevations, which have, of course, as I said, a smaller aerial footprint, crucial for species' long-term survival. And in the Willapa Hills, essentially the entire area of its distribution is within the managed landscape. So fortunately for Van Dykes, close tide of water puts its local distribution almost entirely within the width of riparian buffers that are currently required by Forest and Fish, except for the upper half of the about 50% of the buffer that you have in non-fish bearing streams. So at least in the short term, perhaps the best strategy to try to retain the species is to acquire higher elevation timberlands to enable removing them from production. But we've thought very little about other alternatives. We're pretty much restricted in options to do based on its distribution. And that's what I have for you. Mark.
I'm assuming that these are only associated with perennial streams, or are they associated with intermittent headwater streams?
That depends on what you mean by a perennial stream. I'm sorry I'm being picky here. You have to have near surface water. You don't have to have surface flow. And of course you have a lot of variability in that situation, but at least in terms of where we looked, and we've made quite a bit of effort to look at drier situations and sort of intermediate situations. But one of the things with these terrestrial salamanders, and especially one like Van Dykes, is there's enormous inter-year variability. I'll give you an example. So back in 2001 was a drought year. And in 2001, we worked 14 sites and found Van Dykes at 60% of those sites. In 2003 was a wet year, and we found, this is a terrible example. Forget the number of sites. The point is, if you look at the number of animals that were found, we found the same number of animals, 600 and some, on five sites that we did on 14 sites in the drought year. Okay, so it was quite a big difference in terms of the amount of effort you had to go to see near surface active animals.
Yeah. The only reason I ask that is, as you know, that what are considered intermittent streams receive zero buffer at forest practices. So I was thinking you were mostly limiting your view to the perennial streams as currently defined, and I realize there's some weirdness there. But.
Well, for this project, we did not limit ourselves to that.
They kind of match that, but they don't quite. So you're going where the critters are rather than at a specific regulatory location.
Well, no, in terms of the footprint that we searched here, we randomized to the landscape.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there were a lot of places we didn't find them and things. Now, we have not yet done a detailed analysis on the local conditions which we have for the places in that footprint.
So, Mark, how do you explain the difference between the wood effect and the Cascades, or the non-wood effect and the wood effect and the non-wood effect?
Well, the part that's really confusing is, so there's not a lot of places in the Willapa Hills where you have the kind of type of rocky seep and V-shaped valley wall structure that you have in the Cascades. So the question is it just a difference in
the available habitat positions, and they're focusing on those microhabitats, and they can be, you know, near surface active year round because of groundwater inputs that are below that 14 degree centigrade temperature range? Or is it also in part a situation where the Cascade and